So I remember in grade three, I got walkie-talkies and I brought them in. And I recruited two guys in my class to be my quote unquote bodyguards, and then a few other people to pretend to be paparazzi and ask for my autograph during recess.
All right, and welcome to another episode of the People of Queens podcast. I am here today with the wonderful Jane Hutchings. Jane is from St. John's, Newfoundland. She is a recent Bachelor of Commerce graduate from Queens in 2021 with a graduate diploma in accounting. Jane will focus on public policy and financial economics as a Rhodes Scholar recipient at the University of Oxford in the United Kingdom. Welcome, Jane, to the podcast.
Thank you, Mario, for having me.
And it's so exciting for our listeners. We are still doing the podcast virtually now, and that gives us the wonderful pleasure of having Jane join us all the way from St. John's, with an apostrophe, John's, Newfoundland, on the East Coast. Wow.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm representing the East Coast loud and proud here today.
Yes. What is the weather like? I'm curious what the weather is like.
You know, we have the normal weather here, which is rain, drizzle, and fog. So we did have a lot of snow, but we're having a windstorm currently. So it's a pretty dreary day outside, but nonetheless, we're kind of used to it.
Okay. Very cool. It's very exciting for me because I truly believe that, you know, Queens has people from all over Canada and is a very coast-to-coast Canadian university. And on this podcast is a very good representation because if listeners will remember, my previous guest, Sophie DeGoody, is from Victoria, BC, all the way on the West Coast. And we also had Travis Pink, who's from Tawasin, which is a little bit more east than Victoria. And then we had Anya, who is my last guest, who is from Wolfville, Nova Scotia. And now we have Jane, who's from St. John's, Newfoundland. So really coast to coast, just missing maybe. So I got to find someone from Manitoba or something to fill it out in the middle. But that's pretty cool, I think. Okay, so let me begin with the beer. Unfortunately, Jane can't drink the beer with us today. And yes, it's 3:42 in the afternoon on a Saturday, and I'm going to drink some beer. So that's the privilege of having the podcast and doing it. But I went and I was trying to look for a very Christmassy kind of jazz, or like a wintry one, because Ontario Craft usually is like very summer vibes, especially IPAs. So I have gone with New Ontario Brewing's Tree Topper Red Ale. And now I will read you the description. Tree Topper Red Ale stands tall as one of New Ontario's four flagship brews. Pouring bright amber, anticipate aromas and flavors of citrus, sweet malt, caramel, and brown sugar. It is medium-bodied and lively, with added notes of fig and cocoa, and ends refreshingly clean. Serve with shepherd's pie, which I don't have, but I love how, so every time I read one of these descriptions, they always give me some sort of like recommendation on what I should be eating. So I always find that a little bit interesting. Jane, do you have like water to drink or something while I drink this?
I actually don't. I went downstairs in our home office, but I usually have, if I was having a drink right now, it'd probably be a lime bubbly. So we can hypothetically.
Oh, okay. Bubbly. Okay. I like bubbly. Okay. So I'm going to do a sip and give the listeners a review. Okay. I'm not sure I'm getting the fig. I think that the fig might have been a bit of a stretch, but I honestly do believe that I'm getting some sort of cocoa. I like it. It's a good ale. I'm not a big ale drinker, but I prefer a lager, as people would know, but I like the citrus and I like the cocoa. So that's definitely something to try. I don't know if I would be drinking that in the summer, though. It's not a very summery drink, but that was pretty good. Okay. Jane, do you have any questions about the beer?
No, honestly, I'm more of a sour beer drinker. I really like
Oh,
the
okay.
strong, fruity ones.
You like the sours?
Yeah.
We had that on one episode. I think it was a Muskoka Brewery sours.
Ooh.
Do people on the East Coast drink a lot of sours?
Yeah, I kind of think it's like almost a healthy mix across the board because I know like local breweries are really big here that over the past like 5 years we've had like I don't know, 10 to 20 local breweries pop up. So I think people, yeah, they kind of like to try it all and see whatever local brewery's brewing.
Yeah, that's really nice. It's really too bad that I couldn't have an East Coast beer. Maybe one day that will be an East Coast sour.
East Coast.
There you go. Yeah, that would be exciting. Okay, so let's just dive into it. We talked a lot about St. John so far. I'm curious, we got to start from the bottom to the top. So what was it like growing up in Newfoundland, in St. John's?
I think I look back at my childhood with so many like fond memories. I really enjoyed growing up in kind of a smaller city. I did grow up in St. John's. So St. John's, I think, has, 150,000 or a little bit more population. So it definitely was kind of like a medium-sized place. But one of the unique things I just always found about St. John's is that no matter where you go, whether it's the grocery store or, some type of activity, you're always going to run into a familiar face. So I think growing up, it always had such a strong sense of community, as well as kind of always looking out for the people around you and your neighbors. So I think that that close-knit feel was something that I always enjoyed. And I think I almost, realize how grateful I am for it now after kind of having moved away from St. John's and coming back. It's something that I don't know, I'm always really happy and refreshed to be back here. I also think that growing up, off the coast of the Atlantic Ocean, there's something that's so nice about like the nature and the greenery and like the exploration and creativity that you kind of do. I know that in junior high and high school and elementary school, a lot of our trips and explorations were always involved with, going to different historic sites, taking 1 or 2 hours outside of St. John's. So I think that a lot of our learning was also very much experiential within St. John's and throughout Newfoundland. So I'm really happy that I did grow up here and got to explore, I don't know, all the great wilderness and outdoors that Newfoundland has to offer.
Wow. Very, very diplomatic answer. Very, very polished answer. I really appreciate it. So could you tell us, maybe you talked about how it's a really close-knit community. Are people kind of in everyone's business a little bit?
Listen, I would say that, sometimes it's a double-edged sword because I think everybody's always there for you, but I think we all kind of know maybe a little bit too much about everyone. So sometimes it's funny because, we'll be sitting down at like the dinner table or when we're doing like, Christmas dinner or Easter dinner, and we call it close on a turn because basically everybody will be in a different conversation about a different topic, but then it's close on a turn, but we'll go back to that topic 5 minutes later. So we're always having something to talk about, and it can be anything under the sun. So it could be, honestly anything. So yeah, close on a turn is very practical, as well as everything that's going on in everyone's life. Nothing's really off limits.
Wow. So I'm sure you're probably the talk of the town, little Miss Rhodes Scholar over here, So what was the reaction like at home? Do you have neighbors coming over and being like, "Oh, wow."
Yeah, I have to say one thing about I find especially about Newfoundland and Labrador is that Newfoundlanders are always so incredibly proud of each other, especially when people succeed or have certain accomplishments and achievements because it's kind of like you're one of their own. Like, I've heard multiple people like, "Oh, I'm so proud of you. It's like you're one of my own, like one of my own kids." So I did find out the news when I was up in Toronto. So it all had to be virtual and through FaceTimes and phone calls. But when I got here back this Christmas, yeah, many people stopped by. Lots of people sent me so many nice congratulatory notes and whatnot. So yeah, people are just extremely happy and supportive, and they just love to see, you know, fellow people in their community succeed and do well.
Okay. So going back into kind of a bit of your childhood, did you grow up close to the water? Because when I picture kind of Newfoundland, you know, I'm picturing the Atlantic Ocean, you know, cliffs, kind of Anne of Green Gables kind of thing, you know. So is that resonate with you?
Yes, it resonates with me. But I think sometimes too, like when you search up St. John's on Google, like you'll oftentimes mm-hmm. see like the harbor, and then you'll see like mm-hmm. all the colorful row houses. So that's downtown St. John's. I actually did grow up in like a suburb. So I didn't grow up in kind of like having all that outdoor space and greenery around you. But yeah, kind of outside the downtown core, there's kind of more suburban areas, but then there's also areas that have a lot more greenery and a lot more area around them. However, everything in Newfoundland is super close together. Well, I should say St. John's. So, you know, if we have to go more than 10 minutes for somewhere, like that's long, which is quite a different reality than commuting in downtown Toronto, where 10 minutes is like a blessing. So I would say, like, in order for me to get to the ocean, like probably 5 to 8 minutes. So it's all like I can see it from my window, like outside on like the second floor bathroom. So it's still within like a small kilometers, like proximity. So it's still very much like it's there.
Okay. So could you tell us a little bit about what maybe elementary school Jane was like? I feel like we're getting some very polished answers, but I'm trying to get, you know, in there. What was elementary Jane doing?
So I think elementary Jane, it was kind of funny because in grade 3, I was just kind of like really obsessed with like all like the movies that were out and like being the celebrity and like people wanting my autographs and stuff. So I remember in grade 3, I got walkie-talkies and I brought them in, and I recruited 2 guys in my class to be my quote unquote bodyguards and then a few other people to pretend to be paparazzi and ask for my autograph during recess. So I basically staged this whole like show to live out my fantasy of being like a young child celebrity, like the High School Musical stars. So that's definitely a funny memory. I think that all my fellow classmates all still remember, and we laugh about it. And then I remember there's this whole movement called Burn the Red Carpet, because I guess people were fed up with me.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So you wanted to be growing up, you wanted to be kind of like a movie star. You wanted to be in movies.
I was really involved in music. So I was really involved in like theater and singing and acting and dancing. So I think that my goal was always to be like a Broadway star or like a pop star. I really enjoyed that type of thing.
Okay. So when you were younger, maybe you enjoyed to sing on stage.
Yeah. So I got involved with a lot of theater productions in St. John's. So yeah, I had the opportunity, like I was able to play the role Annie in the musical Annie. I was in White Christmas. I was in Seussical, Scrooge. Yeah, there was a lot of different productions that I was able to be a part of. So it kind of was a really good outlet for me, because I definitely had a lot of built up energy to want to like go and express myself on stage. So yeah, kind of throughout probably grade 4 to grade 12, I did 1 to 2 musicals a year. So I really enjoyed it.
Wow. Okay. That seems like a lot of pressure for a young person to have. So you did like 2 musicals a year in grade 3 and 4.
Yeah. So it definitely, I think the good part about it though, is that I think there was a really big emphasis, especially with my family, that they always tried to make sure that it was a really fun experience for me. So I think because I started at a younger age getting involved in it, that I didn't really get nervous, I would say, in like my younger years. It's funny because when I played the role of Annie, I was 13 when I played it. So I was in grade 7, and it was probably like over 1,000 people in the audience each night. And like, I never felt nervous. And I remember my parents were also like, it's kind of crazy that she doesn't feel like a little tiny bit of nerves, like going out on the stage. And then in like grade 10 and 11, when I would also play like roles in other musicals, I was the most petrified that I'd ever been. So it's almost like when you're younger, you're just so free, like you don't really have fears. And then like, you know, like I didn't have as big of roles as I got older, that all of a sudden this huge fear came over me. So yeah, it's kind of quite funny what happens with age. And as you grow older, you almost instill a bit more fear inside of you.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, you didn't have your bodyguards on stage too.
They were long gone at that point.
Yeah, those are your groupies. Those are the people. Those are your fans. You know, you got to start paying fans to give you flowers after the performances. Wow.
I know. Okay. I gotta always respect my humble beginnings.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm getting now that gives me a better idea of what Jane was like when she was younger. You were a very theatrical person. You like to be kind of center of attention.
Yeah, and I feel bad. My poor friends, I'd oftentimes recruit them and I'd be like, you know what, we're putting on a dance show. Like, this is the set list. Like, let's do it. Like, I was also really into like Toddlers and Tiaras, like on TLC and all those like reality shows. So yeah, I remember like I'd always see it and then like try to recreate it. But I think my friends, hopefully they enjoy doing it with me too, because we did some good stuff for our age.
Nice. So you were into like Dance Moms, I think they call it.
Yeah, definitely like anything. And then like I try to like recreate like the confessionals. So like somebody would pretend to be like the mom talking about her daughter, or like pretending to be the daughter. So yeah, So my little pink camera definitely had a lot of footage on it. Of just, imagine going back and finding that now. There'd probably be a good few goodies on there.
Okay. So we know a little bit about grade 3 and 4. Did you take us maybe a little bit further into high school? You know, where did you go to high school and what was that like transitioning?
So it's actually really unique. So I went to the same school from kindergarten to grade 12.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So really unique. So, you know, my class, so we only had one stream. So I went to school pretty much with the same kids from kindergarten to grade 12. So we had about a class of 20. So it was really like a really unique experience, because we all got to grow and blossom as individuals from literally 5 years old to 17 and 18. So I would say that like they're all still my lifelong friends. But yeah, it's interesting when people ask like what the transition's like from elementary to high school, or junior high and then junior high to high school, because we never really got that. We basically had two schools. So one school was kindergarten to grade 6, and then the second school is grade 7 to grade 12. So the biggest jump was always going to that school in grade 7. But that was kind of the biggest hurdle or jump, but you were still going with the same classmates. So yeah, it was definitely a really like cool, unique experience.
Okay. So you were kind of, those people were kind of stuck with you, and you were kind of stuck with them for 12 years. So by the time grade 12 rolled around, they were well acquainted with Jane, who likes to, there's a lot of baggage there. I kind of like the fact that I had a bit of transition between grade 8 and grade 12, because those two people, versions of me, were very different. Grade 8 Mario, I kind of wish I could go back in time and like just cancel him. I just want to remove him and his existence. But that kind of is interesting for me, because your baggage kind of carried on into grade 12. So I think that's a bit funny. But I was looking, so you know, I like to brag and say I do research for this podcast, because that's literally the only thing I have to do for it. But I did a bit of research. And, you know, the listeners don't realize, but I am talking to a very, very accomplished, successful person, even in terms of their high school accomplishments. You know, is it true that you won some sort of scholarship in high school as well?
Yes, I did too, actually go and attend school at Queens.
Okay. Could you maybe, you know, talk a bit about that?
Yeah, of course. So I was lucky to be one of the recipients of the DNR SOBE Atlantic Scholarship. So it's a scholarship that's usually awarded to 5 or 6 Atlantic Canadians to go to Smith School of Business to study your 4-year undergraduate degree. So for me, that was kind of the golden opportunity that was like, wow, like if I want to go and experience living in a new place, this was kind of the ticket to go there. So I remember I found out like February 2nd at like 5:00 something in the day. It's like one of those moments when like something either like really great or really bad happens, and you always remember like exactly where you were and exactly what happened. So I remember when I got that in grade 12, I was ecstatic.
Okay. So that leads me kind of into my next series of questions, which is, were you, you know, considering Queens as a university when you were in maybe grade 10 or 11, or did it hop on your radar later?
I think Queens was honestly one of the first universities that hopped on my radar in grade 10, because I remember oftentimes they'd bring back alumni, people from my school, to kind of speak about what universities they had gone to. And I remember one girl specifically had spoke about Queens and her experience. And I was like, wow, like that sounds like the experience and the type of community that I want. And at that time, I was very much science oriented and medical school kind of route. Quite different. So I hadn't really even considered business. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of looking at Queens from a very much science, health science focused. But then I actually did the program called SHAD in my summer of 11.
Okay.
And I think that that program was a very pivotal turning point for me to really kind of realizing what exactly that I wanted to study. So I went into that program being like, I want to be a doctor, health science, medical science, and came out being like, nope, I want to do business.
Okay. This is really interesting to me, because, you know, you take Jane, who's in grade 3 or 4, and she likes being the center of attention, and she likes theater, which is, you know, that's one thing. She likes to sing. And then you go into grade 10 or 11 and you're thinking you want to be a doctor. And then grade 12, you want to, you know, you're going into Queens to go to be into business. So what could you maybe can you have you ever thought about that? Have you made sense of that?
Yeah, it's kind of funny, too, because I don't think I've ever articulated in that kind of like timeline. So I think kind of because I definitely also went through the dilemma of thinking, do I want to go study like voice or, you know, do opera studies or something like that? Because obviously I was really passionate about music. But one of the things for me is that I wanted to make sure that music for me was always a really positive outlet, but I didn't want to put too much stress on it where it became unenjoyable for me. So that's kind of why I decided that I wanted to keep it more as a passion or hobby. So I think that's kind of what helped me make that decision. And I think in terms of doctor, I know a lot of my friends also wanted to become doctors. And then fun fact, I'm actually allergic to the cold. Yes. So I have cold urticaria, which is basically I can get anaphylactic, like I can go in anaphylactic shock if I get exposed to cold temperatures, which is quite ironic because I'm from Newfoundland. But I take basically medication that helps like suppress the symptoms and whatnot. So then I wanted to be an allergist because I remember I'd go to my allergist and I was like, fascinated, and I was really fascinated about like, this is such a strange allergy, like nobody has this allergy.
Yeah, you should move to Florida.
That's what everybody would tell me. You're in Newfoundland, they're like, that's one of the worst places to be for a cold allergy.
Yeah, that... Anyway, sorry, continue. So you want to be an allergist?
Yeah, so I think that that's kind of where the whole allergist and doctor, because I was like, yeah, like, you know, I could go and get like my 4-year medical school and then like I'll go be a specialist and an allergist. And I think it was definitely something that I was really interested in. But then I think when I, you know, went to SHAD, and also in my school, I didn't have the opportunity to take any business courses. So all I kind of had been exposed to was science courses. So I think that SHAD kind of provided me with the opportunity to be exposed to more business oriented side. We had like this 4-month long project. And then we did kind of like a Dragon's Den ordeal at the end, like Shark Tank. And I was like, wow, this is so cool. Like going with like our professional gear, like I'm asking for 10% stake. Yeah. So I really enjoyed that aspect. And then I kind of just started to rethink about like, where I kind of saw myself going. And I was like, you know what, I'm going to apply to some science programs and I'm going to apply to some business programs and just kind of see through that, like the type of acceptances I get or any type of funding, and then kind of make my decision from there.
Okay. Wow. Wow. That seems like a very well thought out answer. I really appreciated that. So there's a lot to unpack there, and I found it very interesting. But so how seriously did you take music when you were younger? Because it sounds like you were pretty devoted to it.
Yeah, I took music really seriously. So basically, I think I really started to take it seriously when I got the lead role of Annie, because that's kind of when I guess I was able to more so see that I kind of had potential in singing, acting, and dancing in musical theater. And so then there's like this vocal competition that would happen each year in Newfoundland. So I basically had been in that since a young age, but then kind of started to step it up a bit. So I'd started studying a bit more opera. So like you would sing like a concert group, and you do like a piece in Italian, like a piece in German, a piece in French, and a piece in English that you would all sing. So then I kind of started to like keep musical theater, but also start to branch out in towards more like streamlined or more thought about singing, because oftentimes undergraduate programs, there are musical theater ones, but I kind of thought if I was, I'd do more classical focused. So then I would always, with like my vocal coach, would be preparing for that at the same time as going to like different auditions for things. So I think that, quite frankly, outside of school, that like consumed my everything. So I was definitely a really big arts and musical kind of girl. And then also my school was very musical oriented, which was fabulous. So in grade 8, grade 10, and grade 12, we did 3 European trips and tours.
Wow.
So I like to call that like my peak of performing was when I actually got to sing for Pope Francis at the Vatican in Rome in grade 12. Yeah, in front of a papal audience. I was like, that's the peak of my career. Like, I'm ending on a good note. But yeah, that was kind of lots of the great experiences that singing did for like my confidence and just for an overall passion.
Okay. I really like the opera. I'm a man of the opera. You know, people who know me know. I like, Luciano Pavarotti. That's who I listen to. And then I listen to some pop opera, some Andrea Bocelli, you know? So, you know, I like music. So I know for a fact that, for example, people that do music majors at Queen's, if you're doing vocals, you know, it's a lot of work. You've got to learn a lot of languages. So it's interesting that you mentioned that. Did you have to sing in Italian when you sung at the Vatican?
So the song that we sung at the Vatican was actually in English, but another piece that I did sing was Time to Say Goodbye.
So oh, yes.
The one that, like,
Conte,
yes.
Partiro.
Conte Partiro.
Let's go, guys. Music knowledge coming in. Here we go.
Here's my
shy. Okay. So you also sang that there.
Yeah. So I didn't actually sing that one at the Vatican, but in our trip throughout Italy, we did. Usually that was like our end piece because it's always such like a big, like monumental, dramatic piece. So we would sing that one. So that one is in mostly Italian. So I'm not fluent in any of these languages, whatnot. So it definitely took a lot of work with like either like my vocal coach or with like my music teacher to kind of figure out the right like pronunciation of the words, because it's definitely not easy any other language. And especially when you're singing it in a country where that's their home language, it adds a lot of extra pressure because you don't want to do anything wrong.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. Okay. Like I said, I'm talking to a very impressive person, someone who's also, sung at the Vatican in front of a papal audience. But let's go a bit forward. So you've got a great scholarship, and now you go to Queen's, and you have a wonderful time at Queen's, I hope. And now we're a bit closer to present day, and you've been awarded the Rhodes Scholarship from the Rhodes Trust from Oxford. Could you maybe take us into kind of when you first heard about the Rhodes Scholarship and what got you interested?
Yeah, absolutely. So I heard about the Rhodes Scholarship in, I think it was high school. I kind of heard about a few people in Newfoundland getting it because obviously, of course, it was always great news because there's one recipient each year from Newfoundland and Labrador. So I think I'd always remember like seeing a news segment on it or seeing a post on some type of platform. And I remember just seeing all like the incredible people that would go and get the scholarship. But one thing I also found so unique about it was like everybody came from such cool and different backgrounds. Like it was never like a one shape or size kind of fits all. Like it was all people that kind of had found their own passions, their own groove, what they were interested in, and just kind of use that as a platform to kind of create something and then wanting to continue that on at the University of Oxford. So I think it was something that was always in the back of my mind. But I don't think it was like on the top of my mind in like first and second year, because you usually can't apply for it until like your last year of studies. So then eventually when I got to fourth year and then this year, I kind of was like, you know, like I think it's time that I apply for the Rhodes Scholarship. And it's a bit of a rigorous process because, you know, you have to write a personal statement. So this whole period of reflection, you have to write your academic statement of study to say like what you want to study. So it's a really good thought process either way, whether, you know, I was successful or not, to think about, okay, this is where I am now. Where do I want to go? And how do I think I'm going to get there? Especially after coming out of your undergrad degree. So I kind of thought it was something that I know that, you know, it may not work out because it's such a highly regarded scholarship. But I thought that, you know, there's no hurt in kind of putting my name forward and, you know, taking my best shot at it. And luckily, I had great support from, you know, Smith School of Business, the professors, people around me. So I decided to, yeah, put my name forward and see what happened. And it turned out to be positive. So no complaints.
Yeah, that was good. So you have to start applying in second year.
No. So I applied in this. So usually kind of what the process is so I had to apply in September to Queen's University. So Queen's University has to endorse you. So in order to like apply to the Rhodes Trust, you have to get endorsement from your university. And then once you receive an endorsement, then that's when you get professors and people who have worked with you in the past to then write your references. It's actually a pretty shorter timeline, but you got to have all your thoughts collected. And then I had an interview in November, and then you find out on the same day as your interview. So it's a pretty, you know, fast moving process once you get into it.
Wow. Okay. That sounds very exciting. And did you know, so you didn't know anyone personally who had gotten the Rhodes Scholarship prior to getting it?
I was definitely aware of some of the people's names, and definitely like, because Newfoundland and Labrador is obviously a pretty small place, but I definitely didn't know any of them on like a really personal one-to-one basis. So it was kind of still a net new process.
Okay, yeah. Wow. And do you have any advice maybe for listeners or people who want to, you know, go to Oxford with a Rhodes Scholarship? Maybe something that you learned in the process that might help?
Yeah, I definitely think that if you're even just slightly thinking about it, I think there's absolutely no harm in just trying out the process, seeing what goes. I think if anything, the biggest thing I kind of learned about the process is it helped me articulate like what my goals are, like, you know, in 10 years and 20 years, and kind of think about, okay, like this is where I am right now. How do I think I'm going to get there? And I also think like throughout the process, like, I know it's a very cliche thing, but like show up and authentically be yourself, because I think then that's when you're going to come across to everyone about like what you want to do, and understand that it's so unique and it's so you that like, don't worry about anybody else or the people who have done things in the past, that, you know, you're the person that holds the pen to your story. So you have to be the one that writes it. And I think if you do that, then I think the world is really your oyster. And, you know, if that doesn't work out, I think that you've at least had time to reflect on what you want to do. And it gives you a really good picture moving forward.
Okay. And I guess my last question in this kind of segment is, what plans do you have going forward in Oxford, in the UK? How exciting.
Yeah. So I think that my plans moving forward is, hopefully kind of doing a master's degree that's more public policy, diplomatic, global governance focused, because I'm definitely really interested in potentially pursuing a career in some type of diplomacy, as a Canadian working with international relations with other countries. And then I'm also kind of wanted to pair that with something that's more business focused. So something like financial economics, because I'm obviously a very passionate Newfoundland and Labradorian. So I want to come back home and be able to be equipped to be able to, you know, interact with different regions, nations, municipalities, but then also make sure that I have a strong financial lens to solve lots of complex financial issues that, you know, lots of different places face.
Wow. Okay. So it sounds like you have a very noble goal. You're gonna get educated overseas, and then you're hopefully gonna bring back that knowledge to help out the fellow islanders and fellow Canadians.
Absolutely. I think that honestly, everything that I've kind of done is always been like Newfoundland, Labrador has always been at the center of it. I mean, even getting the DNR Sobey Lennox Scholarship, it was very much like, you know, I was going to Queen's as a proud Newfoundlander and that I was always going to take any knowledge that I received away from Newfoundland and try to bring it back and reinvest it in some way that can hopefully leave like the people and the community better off than it was before.
Very, very impressive. Very impressive. Probably one of the most accomplished people that I've ever spoken to. Wow. So, you know, thank you, Jane. Very, very impressive. So I'm going to leave it there for that segment. And we're going to move on to, you know, another listener favorite, which is called Hyper Beoreticals, not Hyper Theoreticals, where I ask a hypothetical question to Jane. I give her a situation and she has to give me her response. And these questions obviously come from none other than popular pop culture writer Chuck Klosterman. Okay, so this is the situation. Scientists build a massive space station that allows mankind to control the worldwide weather. As a result, there are no more weather emergencies. There are no more droughts or floods or tornadoes, and global warming has been eliminated. However, there is an immediate demand for perfect days because the weather can be controlled. Many people want the weather to be nicer and more predictable. A large segment of the populace wants there to be two specified dates, April 22nd and October 22nd, where every place on the earth would simultaneously experience ideal weather conditions for 24 hours. These 2 days would become worldwide holidays, ideal for weddings, reunions, outdoor sporting events, and any tourism or traveling that demands meteorological perfection. Every community on Earth would have perfect weather on these two designated days. However, the environmental community claims that this might be risky. There's no precedent for worldwide perfection, and environmental leaders fear that this could create problems we cannot foresee. It can't be nice everywhere, says Universal Weather's czar Al Gore. These were written in the early 2000s. At any given moment, at least one third of the planet needs to be dealing with semi-crappy weather. However, no one can specifically prove why this alleged perfection would be dangerous, because it's never happened before. Where would you stand on this issue? Do you want the perfect, although potentially harmful days? So you can think about it, but I thought it would be interesting given your previously mentioned, allergy to the cold. This could be potentially a solution to those who are also experiencing such difficulties.
It could be. I think what happens for me the most is my first gut reaction is to say that I would almost disagree with the perfect weather. But the reason that I disagree with it is, I guess it's more so a question of if the perfect weather means that everywhere is going to be the same temperature. Did they specify that everywhere would
they
be
don't.
The same temperature?
Chuck Klosterman just leaves you to guess. He leaves you to extrapolate. So it's really up to our interpretation.
So say that the temperature has to be the same everywhere. Then I just think from like an agricultural, aquacultural, fisheries, manufacturing, like land. Like, I just think from that type of perspective that it wouldn't actually be practical and it could actually be harmful, because if you think about crops and whatnot, getting that one perfect day, but then going back to the normal climate, I think that it would be it would not be beneficial, because I feel like it would throw off like nature's flow and rhythm, that it would almost kind of be like a jolt in the system. I also think too, that at the end of the day, there's certain places that have different, you know, temperatures and different climates that I think you kind of, certain people migrate to certain places sometimes too, depending on the climate. And honestly, to be honest, living in Newfoundland, Labrador, where, you know, our weather really isn't perfect all the time, we have mostly rain, I think it makes us appreciate the few sunny days that we have in the summer. And it provides a bit of variety for what's to offer. Definitely think we could probably use some warmer weather. But I think especially where it's also hasn't happened before, that's almost a bit too much risk for me to throw the nature and environment out of whack, kind of. So yeah, I'm going to have to go with that. I'm against those days, despite probably it benefiting my cold allergy.
There you go. Maybe when you're arguing this in the UN, you can say, you know, this would personally benefit me. And though still I am, you know, arguing on the other half. So now when you're dealing with actual governance issues, you can say, well, heck, I've already solved the weather problem. So this is a slice. There you go.
Yeah, you're setting me up well. You're this is just a trial for some big day. I'll think back on this moment.
Okay, so I have another one, because I thought this, your answer to this one would be interesting. We'll do it as quickly as possible. For whatever reason, two unauthorized movies are made about your life. The first is an independently released documentary primarily comprised of interviewers with people who you know and bootleg footage from your actual life. Critics are describing the documentary as brutally honest and relentlessly fair. Meanwhile, Columbia TriStar has produced a big budget biopic of your life, casting major Hollywood stars as all of your acquaintances. Though the movie is based on actual events, screenwriters have taken some liberties with the facts. Critics are split on whether the artistic merits of this fictionalized account, they're split on it, but audiences love it. Which film would you be more interested in seeing?
Oh, definitely the independent film.
The independent one.
Yeah.
Okay. The real, the raw.
I think honestly, like, if you're going to have like people around you tell your story, it's best to get it straight from the source than to get it misconstrued along the way. I also think too, at the end of the day, like, you want your story to be told in the most like authentic, true manner, that I kind of think that, I don't know, you'd lose sight a bit of like the core of who you are if you kind of sold it off to like a big Columbia production and had people play it. It's like, imagine now in like 20 years, Columbia does production. It's like, cut to this clip.
That's what I was thinking. They could use this clip in this documentary. There we go. You're welcome, future documentarians. You know, I got you. See, that's an interesting answer. Me, personally, even though no one asked, I would go with the big production just because I want to see who plays me. That's it. That's the only reason.
Yeah, it'd almost be interesting just to be like, okay, like, I'm going to choose independent film, but like hypothetically, like, Columbia, like, pitch me your storyline and like actors and actresses, just to kind of get like, I don't know. I also think today's audiences are becoming a lot more wanting like the raw, unfiltered truth, that you definitely get that through an independent than like a big production. Despite me having my bodyguards in grade 3, you might do Columbia, but I think the more raw, authentic self is 22-year-old Jane.
There you go. There you go. Maybe we'll get a Jane Hutchings docuseries coming to Netflix soon. The Roads. That's my idea. And now you have to pay me if you want to use that in the future. Thank you. Okay. So this will bring us into the last segment of the podcast. Probably the most popular segment and my personal favorite. It is called Facebook Hangover. It is where I go in deep to the Facebook profiles of my guests. And so I will choose a picture and I will describe it. And then Jane is going to give me the context. And I will, let me say, I have absolutely said, I think, very high praise of Jane. But I would think out of all of my guests, which I think have been 9 guests, this is by far, bar none, the largest selection of images I have had to choose from. There, I was overwhelmed in my research. You know, there was an abundance of images that were existing. So if you are friends with Jane, I highly encourage you quickly now to go to her Facebook profile and look at the images yourself, because it's very entertaining. And there's specifically, you know, this is the first time that I found images where I thought, I'm not going to use those because that's hilarious. Like, that's just too much. Okay. So I think I probably know the context behind this image, but I'll do my best to explain it. Jane, it's a large group of people. It's a group image. Everyone is dressed in what I can only describe as probably 1960s, late 60s attire, probably. I could be wrong. That could be earlier. And Jane is in the center of this group of people. And she is wearing a bright red wig, or her hair. Maybe that's her hair. Is bright red in a afro? It's in a poof. A large ball, like a poof haircut.
That's Annie. That's when I played Annie.
Okay, yeah. Awesome. Okay, let me just continue to describe. Thank you, Jane, for explaining. Yes, I'm presuming that she was playing Annie in this, but she has a large red bow in her hair, and she's wearing a very nice red dress. And there's like a group of a cast of characters in this picture. So, Jane, could you give us the context, please? Which you've already given away.
I was too excited. I heard you start describing the wig, and I was like, I think I've only wore one type of wig before, and it's a red curly wig. But yeah, sorry about that. I got too excited.
That's okay.
Yeah, that was when I played the role of Annie, and that was the closing scene when Annie comes out in her red dress. So I guess it was after one of our shows, taking a picture with the cast, you know, on that post-show high adrenaline.
Wow. And how many shows did you have to do as when you were the lead role?
I think we did it for, I think we did 6 or 7 shows. I think it was kind of over, we might've done like 4 nights and then maybe like 3 matinees. And we'd also do like matinees for schools to come and see it. So yeah, it was a good few shows. Yeah.
Wow, that seems very, very intense and professional. I'm very impressed. And could you give, so I'm not that familiar with Annie, but is that the one where it's like, it's a hard not life?
Exactly.
Okay, there we go.
You know it.
Okay, for our listeners, that's all you're getting from me. I can't remember anything more but that. Okay, so this is Jane, and I think, so I can read the description. It's Jane and her friend Grace. Okay. And this is from June 2013. All right. And they're both in a, I would say, 2-person kayak. Okay. It's a bright green kayak. And Jane has got her kayak paddles up triumphantly, raising them in the air, and in the background it looks like they're in some sort of body of water. I can only presume it's a lake or a river, probably a river, and the background has a nice picturesque waterfall. Okay, so is that enough context? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Okay. So it's actually funny because that kind of goes back to the beginning of the podcast when I said we do cool adventures for school.
Okay,
so that was actually a field trip that we did. That's in the Atlantic Ocean, actually.
Oh.
So that's kayaking. And that's, yeah, my best friend Grace and I, there'd be 2-person kayaks. And then at the end of the trip, we like go up by a waterfall and we do like the classic, like, paddles or oars in the air, like smile at the camera. So yeah, that was like a fun trip that we used to do. It was funny too, because am I in the front of the kayak or the back of the kayak in that photo?
It's really hard for me to say.
I'd guess
back, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, because it's funny because the person who sits in the front of these two-person kayaks, they don't really have to do any of the work.
Oh, okay.
Like, paddle along, and then the person who would sit in the back had like the foot controls to the kayak, so they'd actually have to do all the hard work. So I remember when I eventually caught on to that, I used to start sitting in the front of the kayak.
Okay, that's smart, and you can have your bodyguards paddle in the back.
Right.
Okay, and so that was in the Atlantic Ocean, so that was just a field trip that you guys did. Where exactly?
I believe that was in Cape Royal, Newfoundland. So that's a small community that's on the Irish loop of Newfoundland. So it's about an hour, maybe in 10 minutes from St. John's. So yeah, it's a really cool, I don't think it exists anymore, but yeah, it was run by dad and his son, and they basically would do a whole bunch of guided tours throughout like this little inlet in the Atlantic Ocean. And it was really cool. Like, they would take the sea urchins off the rocks, cut them open, and then we'd eat like real sea urchin. And it was cool.
Wow. That's amazing. I really want to visit. Okay.
Yeah.
Some tourism information. Okay. So I have another image. This is also from April of 2013. Wow. This is a
big year.
You know, let me say that, you know, Jade got around in the year of 2013. Like, boy, like you arguably peaked. She's wearing aviators. This is a bold fashion statement that I appreciate. She's wearing some nice aviators. She's wearing a red jacket that has the engraving SBC in it. She's wearing a name tag that says Jane Hutchings, none other. And she is also wearing a tie underneath her red jacket. And she's smiling. And on the left of her is an older lady who's wearing a nice, I would say probably brown suede jacket with a matching brown scarf and a white hat, and they look like they're in the middle of some sort of European square, a square of some sort.
Oh, I think I know what this photo is. I think it was in grade eight, we did, for like our music tour, we did like a Danube riverboat cruise where we stopped in different European countries along the river. And yeah, those red jackets were like our tour, like SBC jackets. That was the school I went to. So yeah, that must have been like where we stopped one day and were able to do like a tour of one of the cities. I kind of want to guess it was maybe Austria in the photo.
Okay, but wow. Austria. Very nice. Okay. So with that, I just want to thank very much once again Jane for her time, joining us all the way from St. John's. Jane, do you have anyone to shout out? Anywhere people can follow you or something of the sort?
Oh, wow. I've never had the opportunity to do a shout out. Yeah. I mean, maybe you don't want to see my Facebook, but feel free to find me on Instagram at JaneHutchings04 or Twitter, which is also JaneHutchings04, or I guess in a more formal setting, LinkedIn. But yeah, wherever you may please, I'd love to cross paths. And if you want to talk about anything under the sun that I talked about here today, I'm always open.
Okay, awesome. Awesome. Well, we'll be, I'm sure, very interested to see what happens. Maybe you'll end up actually being a star in the theater, or you will pursue your education and hopefully return back home and become a positive impact for the New Maritimes and for Canada. So we really appreciate that. Thank you everyone for listening. Thank you for everyone who requested me to continue with the podcast. I know it's been rather irregular, and we hope to see you in the next one. Take care.